de la Defensa Civil Siria, el galardonado grupo conocido también como los Cascos Blancos. Tanto la periodista británica Vanessa Billy como la investigadora Eva Barlett coinciden en que los Cascos Blancos son financiados por el gobierno de Estados Unidos y el de Gran Bretaña. El fundador y director ejecutivo de Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, está testificando ante el Congreso de Estados Unidos para explicar cómo Cambridge Analytica obtuvo información de 87 millones de usuarios para lanzar una campaña en favor de la carrera profesional política de Donald Trump. Escuchemos este reporte de Hispan TV.
El director general de Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, compareció el martes ante el Congreso de Estados Unidos con una disculpa pública por el escándalo de privacidad que ha afectado a la compañía que fundó hace más de una década.
Ya está claro que no hicimos lo suficiente para evitar que estas herramientas fueran usadas para hacer daño mediante noticias falsas, intervención foránea en las elecciones y discurso de odio, así como la violación de la privacidad de usuarios. Nosotros no cumplimos nuestra responsabilidad y fue un error grave. Fue mi error y lo siento.
El CEO de la compañía ofreció aclaratorias sobre el uso indebido de los usuarios de Facebook por la consultoría Cambridge Analytica. En ese incidente, los datos de 87 millones de personas fueron usados por la mencionada empresa, que tenía vínculos con la campaña electoral del actual presidente de Estados Unidos, Donald Trump. Zuckerberg aseguró que no tenía conocimiento de lo ocurrido y se comprometió a tomar cartas en el asunto para que no se repitan los hechos.
Lo que puedo comprometer es que vamos a invertir significativamente porque esta es una prioridad para asegurarnos y que las personas no difundan información errónea o intenten interferir en las elecciones en Facebook, pero no creo que sea realista.
Durante la audiencia, los senadores apuntaron que este escándalo mostró que los usuarios de redes sociales no han entendido por completo qué cantidad de sus datos son colectados, protegidos, transferidos, usados y abusados.
Comencemos con su acuerdo de usuario. Esto es lo que todo el mundo ha tratado de decirle hoy y lo digo con cuidado. Su acuerdo de usuario apesta.
Cabe señalar que el dueño de Facebook ya se había disculpado en repetidas ocasiones con los usuarios, pero esta es la primera vez en su carrera que se presenta ante el Congreso. Antes del escándalo de Cambridge Analytica, Facebook también tuvo que enfrentar numerosas acusaciones a finales del año pasado por permitir la difusión durante la campaña presidencial de 2016 de noticias falsas que habrían podido afectar la intención de voto. Mahdieh Esmailpour, Hispan TV Noticias.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre del Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Here at Free Radio, we know that the airwaves are still dominated by corporate, white, patriarchal, capitalist culture, and we're sending a call out for women programmers who might want to get involved here at the station to apply for shows. We have a lot of openings. You can check the schedule out and see what slots are open at freakradio.org. And in the meantime, tune in 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz.
This is Ward Churchill saying, get yourself a mind transplant. Listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM.
Today is April 12th, 2018, and you're about to listen to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, twice-weekly show concerned with civil rights in Santa Cruz. Where are them? How can we get them? And how soon can we get them back? Covering some interviews with McHenry, Cynthia Berger, S. White, and the gang at the Calvary Episcopal Red Church. Plus, yours truly is going to be elbowing his way in as usual. So stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me mad. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Welcome to another edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris, and you can reach Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, unfortunately not on the air yet. We're still studio searching, but afterwards or during the show, you can leave me a message at 423-4833, 831-423-4833. That's the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom voicemail line, and sometimes a live line to me. $500 reward, still an option for those of you who have any knowledge of or hints to get a 10x10 space somewhere in the broader Santa Cruz area. We're actually expanding beyond the city limits, as I've mentioned in past shows recently. We need electricity, we need internet, we need bathroom, and other accommodations are optional. But get in touch, or, well, either by contacting the phone number, which I just gave you, 423-4833, or going to freakradio.org, which is the website for free radio, in case you don't happen to be there. That's a place where you can also find archives, and you can also find where and how to become a member of free radio, which we need members, so consider joining. Continue to operate without a studio, though it's more difficult, and we will also continue to seek out new members, even without a studio. But help us find one, please. I'm going to apologize in advance for the quality of some of this broadcast. I'm having to do it in a more kind of rudimentary, rough, crummy way because I'm having problems with my equipment, and I have to get some assistance from those who know better than I what to do, and I haven't yet been able to do that in time for the broadcast. So it's going to be a little rough. However, we're going to go ahead anyway because I believe that the content is more important than the style or format or even presentation, although that can make a lot of difference since I know a lot of people probably listen to this show, if they do at all, for entertainment, as well as perhaps for some kinds of opinion and news. So we'll just have to flow with it and blow with it and see what we can do. Just going to give you an update on public records, which I've been looking for. Public records are the documents buried in the government files, which might actually answer questions that the bureaucrats and the politicians want. The concern I've had is the backlog at the city, and possibly the county, of untested rape kits. Story from NPR about untested rape kits. It's a couple years old, but I'm concerned that in Santa Cruz it may still be relevant.
Waiting to be tested.
Let's try that again.
Across the country, sitting in police evidence rooms are tens of thousands of rape kits waiting to be tested. Some have been sitting there for years. But a national push to address the backlog has given the issue a sense of urgency. To find out what kind of progress has been made, we reached out to Becca O'Connor. She's Vice President for Public Policy at the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, one of the groups spearheading the effort. Becca, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Explain why these kits were not being tested.
So 10 or 15 years ago, the DNA technology wasn't in the same place where it is today, first of all. We now are able to pull much more out of a rape kit through DNA testing than we may have been able to in the past. And beyond that, there was also a different mentality around these crimes. For many people, the belief was that these were stranger-perpetrated crimes where you have someone leap out of the bushes, and we know better now. And we have more of a push and an inclination to test, even in acquaintance cases, because we know that these are serial offenders that are likely to strike again.
How much does it cost to process a rape kit?
The average is between $400 and $1,200.
So it's a big hit for cities, especially if they have a big backlog.
It can be, but it depends on what exactly they're planning to test out of that kit. But it's something that, cost is outweighed by the benefit, we believe.
So even if there was no value to the specific case,
mm-hmm.
you're saying that there is still value in testing a kit because of another crime that perpetrator might commit.
Exactly. And over time, the other thing that's evolved, of course, is the CODIS, the National Database run by the FBI, which holds offender samples. And so as that's grown, we have more, basically, things to check against.
And are there examples of finding someone, a perpetrator, who committed another crime because of a positive ID with a rape kit?
Absolutely. So, for instance, there's a woman named Natasha Alexenko, who's a survivor with whom I work, where she learned only after they finally tested her kit years later that the individual who assaulted her had committed other crimes.
There's been federal legislation to address the backlog as far back as 2000. So why is it still a problem?
We talk about the backlog in this generic terminology, and it's important to point out that, for the Department of Justice and others, a backlog kit is one that is sitting at a crime lab and waiting to be tested. And as we've been talking about, we know that many of these kits never make it to that stage. They sit in evidence rooms. So there's this education that needs to happen. That said, we do have this challenge of creating a system where victims feel comfortable coming forward and submitting themselves to these exams in the wake of what's likely the worst trauma of their lives. If I'm a survivor and I'm seeing headlines that say that my kid is likely going to sit and collect dust somewhere, where's my incentive to come forward? I think that's one of the things that we're seeing shift as more and more states step up to the plate and do what needs to be done to clear their backlogs.
As you mentioned, there is some movement here. Some states have really taken this on. Last week, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey announced he's forming a task force to find and test old kits. Kentucky is pressing ahead with a bill that requires rape kits to be tested within 30 days of collection, I believe. I imagine this is encouraging news to you?
It absolutely is. And what's really, really encouraging as I talk to lawmakers across the country and in the federal government is that people are starting to have these aha moments and realizing that, first of all, it's okay to raise your hand and say, we may have a problem here and we want to get to the bottom of it. There's no finger pointing at this point. What's really been amazing, even in just the 3 years that I've been working on this issue, is the shift and the desire to be proactive rather than just reactive to the issue.
Becca O'Connor of the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, thanks so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's an NPR story from about 2 years ago what's being done to address the country's backlog of untested rape kits. For any listeners who are interested in more recent information, although I'm no expert at all on the subject, you might want to check End the Backlog, which is another endthebacklog.org, which is a website which has a lot of information, or seems to anyway, talking about the rape kit backlog. My interest is in getting police departments, specifically the Santa Cruz Police Department, where I happen to be living, this is my neck of the woods, to be transparent, accountable, stop ending practices that abuse poor and homeless people and other groups, women as an example. And in order to do that, we need to get clear records and clear response. I'm not likely to actually carry on with a lot of this research. I kind of simply, well, make the initial attempts, sort of establish the trail of breadcrumbs that others can follow if they want. And hopefully others will be better motivated, have more resources, more time, and more energy to do that. As listeners may know, regular listeners, I did request of Police Chief Andy Mills a few weeks back some information regarding the number of untested rape kits that are currently gathering dust on the shelves of the Santa Cruz Police Department. And I think I asked him this at least 3 weeks ago in a formal written request. He and I ran into each other at the city council study session where he was presenting a long deal about how he has a new procedure. He wants to change the way Parks and Rec activate. And there were some people who liked the idea, like Steve Plaich, an activist who you've often heard me criticize and sometimes compliment, and other concerns, proposals that essentially ignored, I think, fundamental police department abuses and lack of transparency, lack of accountability. In any case, in this particular study session when I ran into him, he did not have the statistics that I asked him to bring along, and so I told him I'd have to make a Public Records Act request. I made such a request. It was delayed. I believe it was delayed. Yes, I think so, because they have to answer it within 10 days, saying they had to check over more records. The request went something like this. Well, this was my original informal request to Andy Mills. Still waiting for an informal or formal response regarding the number of untested rape kits currently gathering dust in the SCPD, for how long, etc. It's not clear to me why you can't provide these stats. Would a formal request from a city council member or a member of the city's commission for the prevention of violence against women make you more comfortable and facilitate disclosure of this information? If there's no problem, let us know. If there is, perhaps the community can help. And then I pointed out a current Sentinel story looking at the Me Too campaign in the, it was a Sentinel story from April 4th, and pointed out that there were 111 cases of sexual assault, rape, and attempted rape reported last year to the SCPD, which may represent only 20% of the actual number of occurrences if you look at the national stats. And there was a Start by Believing Day at the Santa Cruz City Hall, fluff and puff, and everyone get together and come together with the police, everything's hunky-dory, and so forth. I mean, I don't assume that that is what activists with this movement necessarily believe, but that's how the Sentinel seems to be presenting it. And so I wanted to get, you know, kind of tail on this event by saying, okay, so what's the story with untested rape kits in Santa Cruz? And I was, of course, ignored. I actually had made this request, I believe, sometime before this story. But it's sometime in the last 2 or 3 weeks. In response, I got no response from Andy, so what I said was, I sent a Public Records Act request, please make available for viewing all documents referencing rape kits from January 1st, 2010 to the present, specifically focusing on how many were completed and forwarded to the DA for prosecution, dismissed, or still awaiting action. I prefer these documents in email form. Thanks. I'd include as a reminder my prior request that you provide this information informally, which you declined to do. I'd also encourage you to note your lack of response on other issues, which is this one I'd prefer informal dialogue on. And, of course, he has not been providing that informal dialogue, sadly, but perhaps not unexpectedly, because I'm not, you know, the most discreet critic or the most gentle critic, but I try to get to the issue, and it looks like the police department is trying to avoid it. So what I got recently was this response. We have no records related to your request. Your request is overly broad and does not reasonably identify a record or records. However, the city has interpreted your request as seeking a summary or report containing your aforementioned text, which I just read, all documents referencing rape kits from January 1st, 2010 of the present, specifically focused on how many were completed and forwarded to the DA for prosecution, how many were dismissed, and how many were still awaiting action. When phrased as such, the city has no responsive records related to your request. Additionally, police records of an investigatory nature are exempt from disclosure under Government Code 6254. So it looks like they don't want to answer these questions. First, they're saying, we haven't got any records, and if we do, you don't get to see them anyway. Seems to me that knowing that there are rape kits untested sitting on Santa Cruz Police Department shelves is really an important issue, particularly if you're parading around, preening yourself on a good police department or saying you're acting in a cozy, comfy fashion with activists concerned with rape and assault and sexual abuse. So I would encourage other people to get in touch with Mills and ask him about this issue, and I will continue to forward requests for records that they will continue probably to deny, and who knows. I have heard from at least one local legal person that he's willing to work with a person who operates at a distance, out-of-town lawyer, who's willing to take this issue to court to sue under the Freedom of Information Act. I'm more interested, frankly, specifically in homeless people and the kind of abuses they're suffering. Not that rape isn't an important issue. It's an important issue for homeless people as well. But, you know, limited number of hours in the day and so forth. If you're interested in any of the issues that come up on this show, do give me a call at 423-4833 and volunteer your time if you want to put in any time in this, because we can use people who want to do that. The next meeting of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, is on Wednesday, next Wednesday, and that would be the 18th. And it'll be at 11 o'clock at the Sub Rosa Cafe, which is right next to the Bike Church and across from the Yan Flower Restaurant at Pacific and a block past Laurel as you head toward the beach. Thank you.
can lead to lifelike, and lifelike can lead to love. Sure, as the stars above, I'd really like to hold you, kiss you, jack you, wrist you, rim you, race you, kill you, kiss you, fuck you.
And that's my newest discovery, although they've been around for a while, Garfunkel and Oates. It may seem a little strange having that selection right after the criticism of the SCPD for untested rape kits, or for not giving out information on what untested rape kits they haven't tested. But I'm concerned with a lot of issues on this show, and one of them is, of course, breaking sexual barriers as well. Sort of an ancient hangover from decades ago. Who knows? Probably sexually repressed myself. Probably no probably about it. But I like to see these kinds of songs, particularly when they are, they convey a gentleness at the same time as an enthusiasm and talk about forbidden sexuality, perhaps in a way that is not, although it is, I guess these songs are being sold commercially. This duet, these two are on YouTube. You can find them under Garfunkel and Oates. Anyway, I present it for your approval or disapproval. I'm going to pick up on a conversation I was having with tenant activist Cynthia Berger regarding the rent freeze and just eviction protection ordinance passed by the city council as an emergency measure, and a broader measure that is actually coming up to be put on the ballot if it gets enough signatures in an election in November. The signatures have to be gathered by September, and the election itself will happen in November. Let's tune in on this conversation.
Okay, yeah. It's all about now there has to be a reason, and who approves the reason? Not the tenant, the landlord. If they're going to say they're kicking you out, they gotta have only a particular reason, and they gotta be able to prove it.
So now let's talk about how things have improved in Santa Cruz under the current ordinance, but how that would improve further or change further with the passage, first getting on the ballot in September and then passing in November, of the ordinances that are being circulated in Santa Cruz, the rent control ordinance and the just eviction protection ordinance, as I'm fumbling
with. Yeah, so the permanent ordinance has a lot more details about owner moving in and relocation, and it has stricter rules about it and more rules. Then there's also, when they did the temp, we handed them a temporary ordinance, basically. Our lawyers have one, and you know, we customized it to what we wanted in Santa Cruz. But then when the city council got it, they broke it into two ordinances because some of the council members were landlords whose properties could be adversely affected by the law, so they weren't allowed to vote. So they broke it into a rent control ordinance, on which those two landlords were not allowed to vote, and a just cause ordinance on which everyone could vote because the landlord, it just was going to affect everybody, you know, so they just let everybody vote. It was going to affect everybody pretty much the same if you're a landlord. So what happened was the council, it was Rochelle DeRoy, and it was, you know, as far as I know, this is her personal situation, and maybe there are some others who have contacted her about it, but I kind of feel like she was speaking for herself, and she said, hey, well, what if you're, because Just Cause covers everybody. It doesn't matter if it's a single family home or not. It covers everybody unless you're in, a university dorm or a HUD-funded, you know, something that's under a different regulatory sector. So she said, well, you know, what if you just have one rental property? Like, you know, you own your house and then you have another rental property. And then can they be exempt from Just Cause for eviction? And so, you know, that was the main thing that was asked for. And since a lot more wasn't asked for, and it was going to go through pretty much as it was, the other council members didn't argue for too long on that. And so that got added to the ordinance so that those people who live in someone's only rental property are not covered by just cause for eviction. Now, I don't know how many, you know, if there's a problem with that. How do you know how many rental properties someone has? You have no effing idea, because they could have one in Hawaii for all you know. It doesn't say rental property in the sea, rental property in the county, rental property in California. So it was kind of a dumb, it was not a well thought through legally, you know, and it wasn't written well when it was added. So it was very vague.
So anyway,
yeah.
Yeah, the just cause eviction ordinance has incurred some the emergency ordinance passed by the council, and perhaps the ordinance being that part of the rent control ordinance being proposed that goes for just cause eviction has been criticized as muddying the difference or eliminating the difference between evicting someone, you know, with an unlawful detainer. By, you know, in the middle of a lease, whether it's month to month or longer, and at the end of a lease or at the end of a month to month, saying, okay, let's, you know, we can decide to renew or not to renew.
Right.
Now, is there any difference between the current ordinance and the ordinance that might pass in November on that score? And what's your response to landlord critics who say, hey, what if we get a bad tenant and we can't kick them out?
I don't, you know, respond to landlord critics, number one. I just want to say that this ordinance is for the good of the community, and it's going to protect our neighbors who have all been streaming out of here in great exodus in the past 3 years, and for those who aren't interested in that, well, that's too bad. You know, because we do want to have a community that's diverse, that's not all, you know, just one class or one race, except for the small amount of diversity that the University of California happens to bring in. You know, so I don't engage a lot with landlords. If they have a question about the ordinance that I can answer, then I would answer that. So the point you're talking about, you know, right now, the California landlord lobby, you know, led by the California Apartment Association, has a person who's paid to monitor the situation here, who's paid to set up a landlord group. They're having their first meeting tomorrow night, and we will have a spy there, at least one.
Good.
And so they are sending out all of, you know, they are behind a lot of the things that they bring up are the things that you'll see on Nextdoor.com, for example, and that we hear in conversations. They may be real concerns, but they are landlord lobby talking points. They're divisive, and a lot of times they're not true. For example, they say that and then other times they are true. But what is the point of arguing about it? Yes, rent control cuts into property owners' rights. Do we want to go there? That wouldn't be prudent politically.
You know, I would say
it absolutely does, and everyone knows it.
I mean, I think
tenants have a right to that.
I would say it cuts into the landlord's powers and privileges rather than their rights, because I think rights is usually something broader, which I refer to, you know, which refers to a broader section of the community. And, you know, I suppose, anyway, that's how I put it.
Yeah, that's a good point. They always say, like, when they go before the bodies like the planning commission or the city council talking about their housing rights, you know, the rights of a property owner, they always say, like, that's a take. You know, that's, like, the main thing behind all of that. You know, like, that simple line, it's a take. You know, you're taking my property rights. You're taking my right to make a profit off of this property. And so there's a real huge chasm in philosophy between housing is a human right and housing is a capitalistic scheme to make money. There's just a huge scheme, chasm, schism there, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to argue that during a rent control campaign. So,
I appreciate
your appealing to people that it's about the good of any community. I think there should be rent control everywhere in the whole country.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate your position, Cynthia, but I mean, as someone who is trying to present the arguments of the other side to get a response, not because I'm a landlord, I'm not. Not because I have sympathy with the landlords.
I can answer that about the lease. Yeah. So what happens is, you no longer have the right to kick somebody out. The reason people want to kick somebody out at the end of their lease, 99.999 times, is because they want to raise the rent for the same property. And they want to get a person of a different economic class in there. And that's what has to stop.
And while I may agree with you, do we have any evidence in any statistical form that that is true?
That what is true?
That, in fact, of the, 1,000 evictions in the last, or refusals to renew a rental agreement.
I have a lot of proof because I get the calls. I've had many people call me and say, oh, my gosh, my lease, would you like an example?
Yeah. Well, examples, yes, but more. Again, I'm looking for the stats because there are always going to be good examples.
There's no stats. People like, tenant advocates, we're not here like keeping stats.
No, I understand.
We're trying to work on that, but...
No, I'm not expecting you to keep this, Cynthia, to keep the stats. I'm not expecting you to keep the stats. You got your hands are full, but I'm wondering, in other cities, perhaps, this issue may have come, maybe the landlords have tried to present...
It's common sense. Everyone knows it, and it doesn't require stats.
Yeah, well, I'm always wary of the everyone knows argument, but I hear you, I hear what you're saying.
Well, that's how we're going to win the election. We're not going to win by stats at all. Mm-hmm. Because tenants are going to vote for this, because they understand already. They don't need to see the stats. The small landlords that have children that they'd like to live in Santa Cruz, they understand that. And the homeowners, they understand that.
Let's talk about that, because let's talk about that, Cynthia, because when I listen to the latest, frankly, egregious appearance of so-called homeowners at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting last Tuesday, or was it the Tuesday before? I don't know.
Probably last Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, I you get a lot of this, all these other landlords, they're horrible, but what about me? I barely scraped to get...
We're always the good ones.
Yeah, we're the good ones, and we got property, we haven't raised our rent in 40 years, and so forth, so...
Yeah, but guess what? Here's my answer to that. Here's what I have to say to that. Well, rent control allows for a landlord to make a reasonable profit. So it shouldn't really affect them, because I talked to one landlady and she told me, hey, well, I raise my rent by the Consumer Protection Index every year. And I said, well, that's exactly what the law allows you to do. And she's like, oh, really? She thought she didn't understand that. And so that is what's fair, because that's related to people's wages. Right? The Consumer Price Index, I think I call it Consumer Protection Index. The Consumer Price Index. And that's, how you measure what people are earning and what they're spending it on. And so, it measures inflation. And wages have been stagnant for most people for the past 40 years. And especially in Santa Cruz. But the Consumer Price Index has been, agreed in the courts of California to be what you can peg a rent control raises to. So this woman actually told me, well, that's what I do every year. I just raise it by the Consumer Price Index, and that's between 2% and 3%, Robert. And I said, great, then you're a good landlord.
Well, what?
Still
what,
against it. What, still against it, because then they go like, well, what if I want to raise it more? Well, if I need to raise it more, like if I do some repairs, and so the answer to that is, then you go to the rent board and you just show them, hey, I need to do some repairs, so I need to raise my rent a little more than 2% this year, and as long as you can show them that's the fact.
Now, in your conversation, Cynthia, with rent board people in Berkeley and elsewhere. Have you gotten any indication of how landlords have responded to this? Are they, is there any satisfaction from landlords with this approach in terms of its ability to work? In other words, bringing it to the rent board, saying, I did this. There were these problems. I had to raise, more money.
Yeah, they give
Right, but I'm saying is...
Is there any indication
that landlords are fighting to change the law back because of injustices in this regard?
Landlords are always fighting to change the law back for things that they think are injustices. But... They have a landlord group in Berkeley, you know, they have a website and stuff. But what I'm going to do, Robert, is here's what we need in Santa Cruz. We need to have people come here from other cities that have rent control and do a forum for everybody. And I'm talking about landlords as well as tenants and rent boards and even politicians and talk about how it works, not about how it doesn't work.
And do you have any of that planned coming up?
Yes, I'm planning for that, but I don't have a date yet.
I got you.
I'm just planning on studying that out because this is what people need to know. It's working in places. There's landlords that work with it. You know, they're not losing rental housing because of rent control. They're losing rental housing. If they're losing it, it's for other reasons. It's not for rent control. Rent control is very weak.
That, of course, is one of the primary arguments you keep hearing repeated, which is that there's been, for example, a reduction in rental space in Berkeley, let's say, by, I don't know, 9,000 units in the last 20 or 30 years.
These are false stats. I mean, there's other studies now that are available, and I can email them to you if you're interested.
I am.
That show that those are not true.
Yeah, definitely, definitely send that to me.
I'm not good at remembering those, but I'm aware of them.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if you send them to me, I may try to summarize them in future broadcasts.
Yeah, I will. I'll send you a few documents, and some of them are written by planners, urban planners, and you know that are pro rent control. I'm gonna have one of those come down too, mm-hmm. For this shebang. But first, we have to get the signatures to put it on the ballot. That's our task right now. We really need help with that. So anybody listening, please call my hotline 831-222-0359, and you can find that on my website, santacruztenants.weebly.com. It's a free website, so it has a silly word in it. But if you just Google Santa Cruz Tenants, you'll find my website, my phone number.
So give that phone number and the website again, Cynthia.
Thanks. It's 831-222-0359. And that is a bilingual tenants' rights hotline, and I answer it.
Now, is there anything...
I'll answer you right away, and then I'll call you back soon.
Is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't covered that you think is relevant here?
Well, did I answer your question? So, like, one thing that is coming up that is just plain, the muddying of the waters is all due to the landlord lobby. They have millions of dollars. They're going to be putting $1 million against this here. I mean, this is a little gem in the crown, Santa Cruz, where everybody's trying to make a lot of money speculating. So, they're going to put a lot of money against us once it gets on the ballot. They're just waiting to see if we get the signatures. But, so people talk about subletting and the lease thing. Yeah, when the lease is up, you don't get to kick somebody out and charge more rent because once your tenants turn over, you can put your property up to market rate. So how can it be that, oh, this lost so many rental properties? That doesn't make sense because as soon as a tenant moves out, they can put their property up to market rate. Do they, you know, so it really doesn't make sense. Part of the reason also about, you know, just to go back to what you were saying about losing rental properties, when developers and owners lose rental properties, then they make more profit. So they get to gouge. So what is the impetus for them to build housing when with a shortage, they can gouge outrageous prices? They don't have an impetus to build housing because they've manufactured a shortage of housing over the past 40 years. That's never going to, it's always going to be a deficit from this point on, you know. So it doesn't behoove them to build more housing mm-hmm. for anybody, in a way.
Well, I catch the gist of it. The question is, you know, for me, and I'll look at those stats that you're going to show me, has there been a loss of rental housing in Berkeley over the last 20 years? Is it due to rent control or some other factors, if there has been such a loss? And if not, what are the factors involved?
What are these stats coming from? Where did you read them?
The mouths of landlords, of course.
Okay, well, that's just, here's hearsay. So I'm not going to answer hearsay, but if you find stats proving that what the other people are saying, there's going to be a lot of stuff said, Robert, throughout this campaign. And that is planted into the mouths of landlords by the landlord lobby. So I have to tell people right now, you're going to hear a lot of lies. And so until you see the statistics and you understand how people collect statistics, none of that can be believed. Okay, a lot of that is a manufactured talking point, you know, and that's one of them. That's a big talking point. And guess what? People vote for rent control anyway because they look around, they visit a city that has it, and they're like, hey, this is pretty neat. You know, but, you know, as far as the subletting, the only, you know, there are just a couple of changes maybe or clarifications. It's basically subletting is governed by the lease. So that's the landlord's contract. And if the landlord says someone can't sublet, then and it's written in the lease, then they can't sublet. And the landlord has recourse under the just cause eviction if you break the lease. That's a lease clause. If you break the lease, it doesn't matter what it's for, subletting or something else, then you can be evicted. However, some landlords, there's not clarity about subletting a lot of times. I have talked to many UCSC students who have told me that their landlord has a no subletting clause in the lease, but allows them to sublet, has even asked them to just make sure that they run them through the landlord so they can do a credit check, and then the landlord will not put that subletter on the lease, but they allow the students to sublet. If it went to court, the students could say, hey, they allowed me to sublet. They could take them to court and say, hey, even though it says it in the, you know, in the contract, we had a verbal agreement that we could sublet. This happens. This happens. So in the ordinances, you know, things are said about when a student sublets, they are the landlord, not the landlord. The landlord doesn't get the check credit. The student is the landlord. The student is the landlord of the subletter they bring in. They get to check the credit. So things like that. Landlords are not allowed to treat subletters like their tenants. And that's just clarified in some of the ordinances. That's simply California law.
So what are the provisions that allow a landlord to dump a tenant on a month by month? I mean, most people... Same provision as...
As on a lease. I mean, everyone should have a written contract. Every tenant should have a written contract. That's important.
But aren't there a series of specifics in the just protection sections, even of the city council's ordinance, that specify conditions under which a landlord can terminate a lease or, refuse to renew a lease. And it doesn't say just what's in your lease if it's violated, but they're at the end of when the lease is expired, under what circumstances can you dump a tenant? And there's a series of protections.
If they broke their lease, if they committed a crime on the premise that you can prove, if they were a nuisance and you can prove it. Remember, this is a burden of proof on the landlord. If they, there aren't a lot of, you know, if they broke the lease, if they, and that would include subletting if it was against the lease and if the landlord hadn't tacitly agreed to it, even though it was written in the lease. You know, I mean, it's just the same reason for both lease or month to month.
It's just I recall in that ordinance or in the discussions about the ordinance a series of 10 or 12 bases for which a landlord...
There's eight, actually. I was looking at it yesterday, and I thought it was a lot more.
Yeah.
There's eight, but some of them have a lot of details, like owner move-in.
Uh-huh.
And like, if you have a lease, there's fair housing law, but it's never enforced. And so I think, you know, we included some issues that are fair housing law issues, like if you can't tell someone they can't have a family member move in if they're on a lease and they want to have another person move in. So fair housing law says that you can have two people per bedroom plus one. So if you have three bedrooms, you can have two, four, six plus one or three, I'm not sure how that works, one per bedroom more. But you can have, it's two plus one. And so that's fair housing law. And so most, you know, there's a lot of places that have a lot more than that, but you're not forbidden from having more than that. But you're not supposed to tell people they can only have X people in your property. That's actually a fair housing law. It just doesn't get enforced. But there are ways that you can appeal that or get around that. If you have an old property that can't withstand a lot of, like plumbing use or something, you know, if it's old property, then sometimes a landlord could appeal that. But this stuff doesn't go to court. This stuff just happens. Landlords have all the power. So now with this just cause for eviction, you know, it specifically spells out that, hey, if there's a husband and there's a guy and he gets married and he wants his wife to move in, you can't tell him they can't move in. As long as it's a big enough place, because that happens. They say, well, no, we only want the people on the lease here. You can't do that anymore. They're taking away some of their rights to, basically it's discrimination and it's,
Cynthia, is there a place where we can find the specifics of, what allows a landlord to terminate a lease, in terms of the specifics? You say the 8 conditions you were reading about. Is that somewhere online?
That is on the city. If you're how to find it real easily, just type in City of Santa Cruz Rent Control Ordinances. Or just City of Santa Cruz Rent Freeze Ordinances. And if you type those 7 words in, then it'll take you to a page. And the city has posted both of the ordinances plus a frequently asked questions document. I don't know if they're still updating that. And they have also had the frequently asked questions translated to Spanish. So they're all on the city website. But another place you can find information is, and also if you want to see the full, the ordinance that we're proposing to put on the ballot, the new ordinance, that is on the movementforhousingjustice.org. And that's the website for the coalition.
And that actually is where I'm looking right now. And I see the eight circumstances, which, just for the benefit of those listening, failure to pay rent, breach of lease, nuisance, illegal activity, failure to give access, necessary and substantial repairs requiring temporary vacancy, owner move-in and withdrawal of rental unit permanently from the rental market are the apparently conditions where you can terminate a lease or refuse to renew a lease.
There that is, I'm looking into more detail. I don't think they give you the details on that website so much, but when they need to remodel, they don't get to kick you out anymore. You can go find somewhere else to stay, and then you get to move back in, and they don't get to raise the rent. Unless that was some required work. If they're just trying to pretty it up because they want to rent it to somebody for more money, they don't get to do that. They don't get to kick you out and then so-called remodel, which means just do their normal maintenance that they usually use the tenant's deposit. A lot of people use the tenant's deposit to do their maintenance, which they're not supposed to do. I get calls all the time, sorry for you good landlords out there who don't do that, but it does happen, and it's a major issue all over the state. But at any rate, so if like I got a call from somebody, you're gonna the landlord said, "Oh well, we're gonna remodel, so I'm giving you 2 months' notice." Well, the 2 months' notice effective date fell after February 13th. And that is no longer a reason for eviction.
I mean, and February 13th, of course, was the date when this ordinance was passed.
That is when it was passed and when it went into effect. So they can, in other words, what I'm saying is that the tenant has the first right of refusal when the work is done. And I don't think they can raise their rent if they decide to come back, but I have to clarify that. So that some of the mechanics are not really well spelled out in the rent freeze law, but they're spelled out in more detail in for the permanent ordinance is what I was trying to think of. The permanent ordinance has more detail.
And Cynthia, I'm gonna leave it there because I think we've covered a lot of ground, and I want to take a breather myself.
Yeah, we could bore people. We're at risk of boring people.
We're at risk of that, but also we're also hopefully educating people as well. And again, if people people want to reach you to get more information, to volunteer to help, or to throw crazy questions at you, how can they reach you one more time?
Well, we really need help gathering signatures, and we'll pair you up with somebody who has done it before, and just any hour you can spend, or if you can get 12 signatures from your coworkers. There's a lot of people working here are renters, and if they live in the city and they're registered to vote, they can sign your petition. We'll train you. The number to call is my number, 831-222-0359, and that's Santa Cruz Tenants Association hotline.
Hey.
And I'm Cynthia Berger.
Okay. Cynthia Berger, thank you very much. Anything else?
No, but thank you for doing this. There was actually on YouTube, there was recently a show. Brian Schulman is doing some shows about the rent control campaign, and he had some realtors and some tenants and some homeowners, and, you know, people who are pro and anti-rent control on. And one of them was named Data Khalsa. He's a realtor. And at one point in the YouTube show, he said that the city of Mountain View is that there isn't, you know, since they got rent control, they haven't had much building. And so there's a lot wrong with that, and it's not true also, because not at the current law in California, anything built after 1995 isn't even covered by rent control. It doesn't matter if it's an apartment or what. Everything covered by rent control is old now.
So I'm going to suggest that people check out YouTube for Community TV, Brian Schulman, Rent Control, and see if you'll find something there. And I'm going to leave it there, I think.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Cynthia.
Come get signatures.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, Robert.
And if you want to hear more, possibly what Cynthia Berger was talking about regarding rent control, there is a panel which you can find by going to the YouTube channel and searching for Santa Cruz Rent Control, and you'll find a Voices from the Village episode a year ago that covers it. I don't know that it goes, probably doesn't go specifically into this ordinance that we've been somewhat listening to a discussion of, but rent control is the issue that's apparently covered for an hour on community TV at that time. Another number from Funkle and Oates. Here's a song called The Loophole. The video that goes with it. And some of the description is as follows. In high schools across America, Christian girls are saving themselves for marriage. Many of these, quote, virgins are having anal sex because the Bible does not specifically forbid it. This practice is called God's Loophole. The song is The Loophole.
Do what my mom and dad and God say I should. Go to church and Bible school to live by God's rules. So whatever people tell me that the Bible tells me, I will do. Walk the halls of high school with my purity ring. Unlike those other girls, I got my morals in check. It was easy to do till I got a boyfriend and pardon my French, but he's cute as heck. But I made a pact to keep my hymen intact, and Jesus and I are tight. Never learned about the birds and bees. I was taught to keep an aspirin in between my knees. Cause the Bible says premarital sex is wrong. But Jason says that guys can't wait that long. I don't want to lose him to someone who'll do him. I need to figure something out. Well, there's a loophole in the scripture that works really well, so I can get him off without going to hell. It's my Hail Mary, full of grace. In Jesus' name we go to fifth base. Well, thank you for making me holy, and thank you for giving me holes to choose from.
from, and since I'm not a godless whore, they'll have to come in the back door. Therefore, fuck me in the ass, cause I love Jesus. If the Lord would want it that way, give me that sweet sensation of a throbbing rationalization. It's just between you and me, cause everyone knows it's the sex that God can't see. It's hard to be as pure as me, to resist the urge to lose my vaginal virginity, to wait until my marriage. To get myself in my unsullied maidenhead. So take your cock out, shove it in my ass, fuck me until you come. Oops, I mean, let's join our souls and unite our bodies and fly with the wings of God. Whatever you do, don't touch my clitoris. If you ring Satan's doorbell, God can't ignore this. And no prophylactics when he's put it in. Chicken birth controls for sluts, and it's a sin. I've emptied my bowels and laid out the towels. I'm ready for romance. Now I'm praying to the power that's the highest. But of all of my souls, this one's the driest. And we can't procreate if we anally copulate. And God's okay with sodomy, but only if you're straight. And I'm staying pure no matter what. So I'm okay with everything but, everything but, everything but. Whoa, fuck me in the ass cause I love Jesus. The good Lord would want it that way. Give me that sweet sensation of a rock hard rationalization. It's just between you and me. Cause everyone knows it's the sex that God can't see. I do whatever the Bible tells me to, except for the parts that I choose to ignore because they're unrealistic and inconvenient, but the rest I live by for sure. So let's not talk about how the good book bans shellfish, polyester, and divorce, and how it condones slavery and killing gays, because those parts don't count, of course. Let's cherry pick the part about losing my cherry and mine it for ambiguities and omissions to circumvent any real sacrifice, but still feel pious in my arbitrary parented position. And don't you dare question my convictions. And don't look closely at the contradictions. Just focus on a sacrificial crucifixion. And have faith in its complete jurisdiction. And the only way to measure if you're good or not, and in a debate just say to have faith, because when up against logic, it's the only card you've got. So close your eyes, take a deep breath, and fuck me in the ass, because I love Jesus. The Lord would want it that way. Give me that sweet sensation of a rational rationalization. It's just between you and me. Cause everyone knows it's a sex that God can't see. Yeah, my chastity belt has locks, but sometimes you need to think outside the box.
And that was Garfunkel and Oates, The Loophole. I recommend if you liked that song or found it stimulating in some way, or maybe you didn't like it, but you're more curious about its presentation, it is available on online. Again, Garfunkel and Oates. And there's a lot of video with it. We're not talking porno, we're talking satire. Not that there's anything wrong with porno, but this is a harsh and very funny critique of Catholic conservatism and contradictions around sex. I'm regularly getting emails from Julie Scholl of RV Full Timers. She lives in her vehicle and is sort of a civil rights fighter for people who are trying to survive where their home is their vehicle, their car, their RV. In Santa Cruz, that's becoming increasingly difficult, as it is in other oceanfront communities and other places generally. I, frankly, am interested in the resistance to essentially gentrification folks who want to remove people in RVs from the area. We saw this effort spearheaded by Rochelle Noroyan a couple years ago, trying to establish a complete ban on RVs in the city of Santa Cruz at night. She didn't succeed because of the Coastal Commission's requirement that there be access to the coast for RVs, but it's not clear whether this isn't being done incrementally, this attack, well, it's a continuing thing, this attack on people in RVs and living in vehicles who have no other choices, really. Here's a story from Washington State, at April 9th. from the Daily Planet? No, the Daily World. Things quickly turned confrontational Monday afternoon at the large homeless camp along the Chehalis River in Aberdeen when members of Revival of Grays Harbor, a support group for the homeless, encountered a group of people who wanted the camp cleared out. About 17 people came to speak with inhabitants on the river as part of a new group led by Ocean Shores resident Sam Hutchinson, who has received permission from the riverside property owner Mike Lang to help clear out the campers. This is the group that the Revival of Grays Harbor group apparently was trying to persuade or dissuade and defend the homeless from. "This is the end of Tent City, the end of excuses," he posted on Facebook. "Slowly but surely, we'll be removing every vehicle, every structure, and move to cleaning up this property and giving it back to the man who owns it." Hutchinson said his group wants to help the homeless by finding them better housing and resources. And, of course, this is what has often been said by people in Santa Cruz who are in favor of the sleeping ban. That was a favorite phrase of the progressive politicians who were following the lead of former city council member and Mayor Mike Rotkin. That the camping's too bad for them. We need something better, so we should make it illegal to camp until someday in that bright utopia on the distant horizon when there's actually an alternative. And until then, get out of sight, get out of town. Although, of course, that's not the proper phrase for feminist socialists to use and progressives in Santa Cruz to use, or Green Party members like former Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice to use. A lot of my references are dated, and I hope that this whole mentality is dated, but I'm afraid it probably isn't. More from this article. Hutchinson says his group wants to help the homeless by finding them better housing and resources. Lang has been trying to regain control of his property for several years, but even when he has been successful with the help of the city, homeless campers quickly return. Lang has said he would like to sell the property, but conditions on it, including a major problem with garbage, make that difficult. The old property rights versus human rights kind of issue, you figure like you have a right to expanses of property when some people have no place at all to live. You're not going to use the property but hold it for profiteering. Similar to the rationale for regulating rents in Santa Cruz, actually. The notion that the person who owns property has some absolute profound right to it, and regardless of the needs of others in the community, is not my favorite argument. The group had let it be known that they were coming to the camp Monday, and members of Revival of Grays Harbor were waiting there. Some heated arguments broke out, and Aberdeen and Hawquiam police were called to ease tensions. So far, the new group has only taken a few minor actions. That's the group that wants to oust the homeless, such as towing a van filled with one riverfront camper's belongings to the edge of the property last Friday. People living along the river later pushed the van back. Members of Hutchinson's group said they intend to spend this Friday moving all the RVs and vehicles out of the area with a tow truck. But Hutchinson and the rest of the group's members say they don't simply want to move people out, they want to find them better housing. "By no means do we want to just displace these people and bulldoze it down," he said. Hutchinson said he has people lined up willing to offer housing for the approximately 75 to 80 who live along the river. Although this article makes no mention of that. On the specifics, anyway. On Monday afternoon, their goal was to survey how many structures and people were on the riverfront area and also inquire about helping get everyone who doesn't already have one an ID card, which Hutchinson believes they need to get a job and find other opportunities. Upon driving into the camps, they were met by about 8 members from the Revival of Grays Harbor, a nonprofit homeless assistance group that was formed 2 years ago and offers free services and goods from its downtown store that supports the homeless community. The Revival members, as well as several from Catholic Community Services, then conversed and argued with the members of Hutchinson's group. Emily Reed, the president of Revival, said she wished they would work with already established groups to assist the homeless community on the river. "If you have a place for them to go, come to our office, sit down with them, and sign the paper to get them into housing," she said. After the parties argued for a while, police showed up and explained that Lang requested Revival members to leave so Hutchinson's group could do its work, speaking with tent residents. Axel Colts, who works with Hutchinson, said he thinks a separate meeting with Revival could have been helpful to avoid the debating. It's a little unproductive. I think it probably needs to be a separate meeting, set aside, and rethink what we're doing instead of coming down here guns blazing, he said. The members of the new group and Catholic Community Services then went through the camps asking whether they would like new IDs and handed out business cards directing them to services. There were mixed responses. Some said they would appreciate an ID card and gave names, while others were resistant or said they already had them. Shirley Owens, who has lived on the river on and off for several years, said she thinks it makes more sense for Hutchinson's group to work with established homeless assistance programs. He comes back with a politer attitude, but he's still giving us an ultimatum and says he has the authority. But what authority, said Owens? We haven't seen any paperwork or anything like that. He's posting all over Facebook, and it seems like a publicity stunt. If he wanted to work with us, he would collaborate with the organizations that already exist and know us better. I don't know if I entirely agree with that, although I don't know about those local organizations up in Washington State. But it looks like a few of them showed up to at least defend verbally the rights of homeless people and to get a little of the other story into the media. Not much of it, but some of it. Hutchinson, that's the homeless get-out guy, said he would be going down to the camps on Friday to remove vehicles. A month or so ago, the city notified RV owners that they had to move the vehicles. A few did, but most didn't. He is also working to get donated trash cans from LeMay Gray's Harbor to offer a free trash service for those living along the river. That sounds like a service. At the request of Hutchinson, Aberdeen Mayor Eric Larson sent a letter to LeMay Gray's Harbor, indicated that the city of Aberdeen did not object to them providing gratis dumpster service to the property on the river. Larson said the city will remain neutral on this issue, and that he views this to be a private matter and feels it would be inappropriate to engage in taking a side at this time. Except you have to move out. And that's a story. Groups looking to clear out riverfront camps, clashes with others during visit, by Lewis Krauss, April 9th, in the Daily World. So now let's jump back to the conversation I was having with co-founder of Food Not Bombs, Keith McHenry, while the two of us sort of lounged or shivered or sat on a bench in the early evening on Pacific Avenue chatting. And the issue that came up, there are a number of issues that came up, but one was Brent Adams' attempt to get a sanctuary village through a kind of encouraging non-governmental agencies and the city and middle-class groups to come together and support it, because of its reasonableness and because it would be managed with rules and so forth, and it would be a better alternative than having people camp all over the place or spending a lot of money on driving people away. Brent was pretty adamant that using protest in Santa Cruz to affect this aim had not happened, that it had bad effects by subjecting homeless people to penalties and making it more difficult for them. And we were talking about the River Street campground out on Highway 9, which I've talked a bit about. I may actually get an interview with Joyful Heart, who I've talked about and talked to in past shows, before this program is over, but we'll see about that. Let's listen to what Keith has to say about this, and you heard some of this earlier if you were listening on the Sunday show, but we're just backtracking a slight bit for those who didn't catch that, and we'll catch the rest of it.
I had suggested early on in a non-confrontational way that one would want to be careful about such a thing, because if the city is not very progressive, they tend to turn them into kind of concentration camp type things, minimum security jails. And so I found it interesting that his...
And of course what we're talking about here is how camps run by government agencies can become, well, more repressive than assisting.
Description of the Boneyard campsite was...
River Street campground, please.
Was exactly as I had warned him about, Because it's you know, he was like thinking he was going to have this alliance with the city council, and the city was going to somehow embrace and work with him to set up a camp that everybody could stay in.
And I believe he still has that hope.
Yeah. But this, in this particular case, the camp that got set up is not so friendly. His critique was this, that a high percentage of the people there are in this clean sweep program.
Oh, the downtown safety team.
Yeah, yeah. They go,
and the little orange jackets.
So. Correct. So that they seem to have gotten priority for the campsites. And then... And then it's costing $90,000 a month, and he said he could do it for a whole year for $100,000, and something of that nature. He says, I mean, I'm sure you could do something like that for $100,000, and that it was like having a police station near it and guards outside and restrictions getting in and out, and all this was inappropriate.
No visitors.
Yeah, so he was not excited about this camp, which I found interesting since it kind of is what he was... It was what, you know, I warned him that that's what can happen if you get a government too involved in a homeless camp like that. And that there was examples of that, like the one in San Jose in the old days and the one in St. Petersburg, Florida. And, you know, there's...
What do you hear about the encampments outside the River Street campground and out? We know that the, you know, the homeless shelter winter program is closing down. Half of it closed down at the end of March. The rest is going to close down within a few weeks, likely. And that, of course, is only only a fraction of the people anyway, but most people who are outside sleep outside either in small groups or some of them, I guess, in makeshift encampments, though I haven't really been aware of anyone particular at this point. Have you had any experience with those in the last couple months?
Yeah, well, I do interview or talk to people about that and ask how they're doing and hang out with them. And so there are a number of somewhat hidden camps on the periphery of the community. And one of the safer areas seems to be up by, by one, as before it makes the fish hook, and mostly on this side, the downstream part of San Lorenzo River, up in those bushes.
I thought there were people there, but then I've noticed some kind of, looked like enforcement activity there a few days ago, and I haven't checked recently.
Yeah, there is everybody is complaining that they're, that I've run into, that their belongings are being taken
by
the police and the rangers, but mostly the cops is what most people are reporting, and that it's noticeable at Food Not Bombs that people that traditionally have gear don't have anything when they arrive. You know, there's a lot of people where, you know, like, so Dreamcatcher lost everything. Of course, he went to jail.
Is Dreamcatcher currently in jail?
No, he just got out, but he has nothing. He has no bikes, no nothing, none of his artwork. All of his artwork was taken. Everything is gone. Bob lost a lot of his stuff when he had a heart failure and ended up in the hospital. He's down to... He used to have a bicycle with lots of things on it. Now he has a... I think he eventually upgraded to a trolley thing for a
trailer.
The one you unload a truck and you move boxes around with it.
Hand truck
type thing. So he's... So Julie's lost a lot of her stuff, but she's got like a new wheelbarrow that looks like it's pretty good. But a lot of people are complaining that they would lose their stuff. So that does seem to be it. And there's a certain anger towards the police and rangers now that was not there during when the Benchlands was a campsite. So that tension, and we have the first kind of couple of yelling things, not very dramatic or anything, but there's placid at the Food Not Bombs meal for all through that whole time of the Benchlands, and we had even really higher numbers than in the past, and now there's a little more tension because the cops are jacking people up a lot more. So that's too bad. Then I heard that there's some kind of new thing with Orange County.
Yeah, Orange County is
around that.
There is some concern, I guess, Judge Carter, I think that's his name, David Carter, was actually on-site monitoring police enforcement of driving away people from the Santa Ana Riverway area.
Yeah. And what they're saying was 400 people, but to me it seemed like in that video of the dude riding the bike on, it had to be way more than 400, but I guess it could have been 400, or it could be 400 since the driving away of people originally or something.
Well, what happened was they, I guess Carter kind of, through appearing in person on the site a number of times, intimidated the authorities into providing 30-day motel vouchers. But it's the same problem as the so-called pathway to housing at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, or the navigation pathway to housing in San Francisco, or the Boneyard campgrounds. Supposed, I guess they're claiming to, they're doing a pathway to housing through them extended. They're talking about setting up a large tent like there is for the sports teams that are up here beyond, you know, the.
Yeah, maybe not.
What the hell? No, maybe not that. But yeah. A big tent.
Like
San Diego.
Yeah, they seem to like that San Diego thing where they set up on a parking lot. So these kind of relatively large.
You're right. The authorities, the ACLU and I guess Carol Sobel, and maybe it's the California Rural Legal Assistance. I'm not sure who's doing it down there, but they're concerned about police seizing property the way police seem to be seizing the property of people like Dreamcatcher, Parks and Rec, homeless people we know. And
it's a kind of a, well, I found it interesting that a city employee, I guess she wouldn't mind, I was saying, Chris, who's partially funded by the city and partially by Encompass or something like that, who does a, supposed to be the downtown homeless liaison person to help the homeless, so she's very compassionate. And she seems to be getting quite dismayed by the basic way that the system surrounding homelessness is, and in far as, you know, like that, feeling helpless, that there's no place to send anybody to get almost anything. She started a study, apparently. She was interesting. She read a lot. She gave like a report at Penny U. And
that's where we began this conversation. Yeah. You said that on Monday night, where there's this regular meal at the Calvary Episcopal Church, or the Red Church, is also in the same building, a presentation by Paul Lee and sometimes Ed Fry of what's called Penny University.
Well, both of them were there, and so it happened. Yeah, it was interesting.
She gave a speech.
She talked about, you know, and she didn't really talk about what she does on a day-to-day basis as a homeless outreach person, but she ended up giving kind of an interesting overview. She had come across a document that showed basically the planned failure of the government to basically not ultimately. Here's one of her points, is like housing and urban development for housing went from like almost $40 billion in 1978 down to like $8 billion now. And that, you know, and things like that. She was seeing that, like, national policies seem to, that it was, like, real, essentially hopeless. That all these, you know, they've now transferred everything to the city, has to handle the problem, but they don't give the cities money. That every city doesn't want to do it, have a solution, because then all the homeless will come. The big myth that they'll all come to Santa Cruz if they actually do something positive here, so they, so no cities do anything because every city is fearful that they will be the magnet, and that the federal government, for since Reagan was president, has basically washed its hands of dealing with this in any kind of coordinated national way, and so she seemed very pessimistic as a result.
And you're writing a book, Keith, about your life experiences. What decade should we expect this book to be finished?
I actually am going pretty fast. If I wouldn't spend so much time talking to you on the radio,
that's a good point.
I would theoretically be home writing right now, but it's going pretty fast, and I suspect it'll be the first draft should be done by the summer.
You know, your audio reports provide the true journal of your life experiences. You probably had more interviews with me than anybody in history.
That's probably true. Yeah, I would say so. In fact, I think I gave my first interview. You had a Royal typewriter on a card table in front of City Hall.
Santa Cruz.
In
1988.
Yeah, I first walked up and there you were. It was a very nice typewriter. I have to say, it's one of the nicest maintained typewriters I'd seen up to that point.
Man's typewriter is his lifeline.
Yeah, so that
it used to be.
Yeah, and there was a street shit sheet that came out. It seemed to be pretty regularly. More regularly than the San Francisco Chronicle, it seemed like.
No, not that regularly, but we had more information.
Yeah. And, it's funny. And I've been going through checking out old newspaper clippings. And, you know, somebody from Hey, That's for Neighborhood Council put up all these newspaper clippings.
You were telling me that.
But it's kind of funny. In some cases, like, it only has the... You know, whatever page one, they don't have that. It starts always at the second page of everything.
It's kind of tantalizing. Rather than continue this elliptical conversation about out-of-print publications that nobody knows what the hell you're talking about anyway, we'll conclude this with give you the last word.
Okay. Well, anyway, I do have to say when I'm writing this book, I'm very excited about it, and so all I think about is writing this book. And so... I often discover that I'm having a conversation with somebody, and the whole time I'm like running some where the last place I was just writing is also going through my head at the same time, or some aha moment is occurring that I should remember, or maybe I'm remembering too many aha moments. And
does it help you to be writing in public places?
Actually, you know, I used to always write in cafes. I wrote the last two books in cafes, but that was also because I lived in a van a lot of that time, or I lived with a girlfriend, and it was too hard to write at home. But this one I'm writing almost, you know, largely at home. It's kind of interesting.
And we've been listening to the questionable ruminations of...
Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Out Bombs, but also, last thing is 38th anniversary is coming up. And we have a photo show at the museum. We have a concert, which is at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on May 24th, Thursday night. Jeff Ott will be performing. Jeff Ott... There's an old Food Not Bombs activist at the time of Green Day was activist in East Bay, Food Not Bombs, back before Green Day signed. And in fact...
we love you!
In fact, I think Green Day used to open for Jeff, so it was Band 15, so that's exciting. And then the Raging Grannies will be there, and there's going to be... It's a lot of... cool things happening with that. And then we're inviting everybody to come out and play music, set up tables, sell jewelry, literature, whatever you want, on the last Saturday of May at Soupstock 2018.
Mark your calendar and get ready to hit the road for Santa Cruz. And we've been talking with...
still again, Keith, with Food Not Bombs.
Thank you, Keith.
Oh, yeah, Belarus. I just read an article about Belarus Food Not Bombs. They do it 3 times a week in Minsk. And the other thing is that there's several other cities in Belarus do Food Not Bombs. And there's a fantastic new video about Bangkok Food Not Bombs.
We'll get that next time, Keith. Thank you.
So what else...
All right, well, I've got on the line activist Brent Adams, and we're going to try to find something to talk about, but I don't think that's going to be hard, because I was looking online at your latest Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz. The only thing I could find that was really recent was a story about a woman barred from access to the downtown library. You want to talk about that?
Sure. Now, that's a person, of course, you know, potentially with mental health and or, you know, addiction challenges, and really focuses, like some people do, on a certain, in a certain territory where they feel most either at home or safe, or that's just where they, that person is. She doesn't seek shelter. So she's been around, you know, since the days of the city hall clear out, she's been there. And so she congregates, she hangs out near the library on the benches. You know, people come and see her. There's a few, three or four people who circulate in that area, and then they move, you know, a block over. And, but she keeps to herself. She has, you know, some bedding material on a cart walker. She does sleep in the open from time to time during the daytime. I think maybe the addictive substance that she uses has her up a lot and then sleeping, you know, in large chunks. So I understand why she posed a challenge for the management of the library, but, you know, I think it was aggressive to, you know, have people get cited, and, you know, it's essentially a stay away order, but I think they went about it in a different way than a normal stay away order. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah, actually, I think I mentioned in the past, maybe not to you, but on the show, the whole stay away order structure that was voted by law by the city council and then twice amplified in subsequent laws came from a kind of policy decision by the library in 2012, 2013, thereabouts, where they adopted this policy of creating a one-day stay away, a week stay away, a month stay away. And this was cooked up by and ratified, I don't know if it was cooked up by David Terrazas, but it was ratified by him when he was on the board, along with other members. It was opposed by some people. I think Catherine Byers, when she was on the board, voted against making sleeping one of those crimes for which you could be bounced from the library, even though you weren't engaging in any criminal behavior.
Yeah.
You know, so, so what was this woman accused of doing? I mean, I see you have a picture of her face concealed as she's sitting on a bench, and also you have a picture of her kind of stay away order, although it's not a legal stay away order in the sense even of the Parks and Recs notices they give when they give an infraction crime claim out to a person. She's not considered guilty of any crime, but what did she do that, or did, and I take it you got only her account on this?
Well, I mean, I know intimately what she's been doing, which is behaviors that would challenge any normal business residence, even a library under its normal operations, being that she, you know, essentially lives outside on the property. So that, and what they've hatched Mark off there are, you know, the X's, I think, you know, blocking aisles, which I think those lists are particularly meant to be inner library behaviors that they've cited, but she never goes into the library. Maybe she goes to the bathroom from time to time, but I think like smoking and blocking and laying down, I think those are things that she's been doing on the exterior, and I think they just used that form as a device to get rid of her for a few weeks. I think this might be her second notice. I know she had been not in the area for the last week prior to this, showed up, and then they were a bit aggressive, I think. The manager came out, and then the security guard, and they were, I would have to say, uncharacteristically unkind.
You witnessed the whole thing, right, Brent?
I came up after the fact, while she had already torn up the envelope containing the thing. I sat down. I usually have, you know, an iPhone ready to take a photograph, but I was keeping my distance. They were scowling at me in particular, as though, you know, they didn't want me to, you know, and they were being kind of, like I said, unkind to her, which I think I wish that Miley or some of the other aspects of the library that have provided outreach to people who sleep outside, particularly the coffee talk thing in the morning, Thursday mornings, that maybe Miley would have been, you know, somebody has a little more outreach capacity for the library. But I, on the other side of the coin, we know it's true that any business has the right to refuse service to someone, and it is technically their property. So I don't really know how to make the judgment that this is a terrible thing that has been done by them. It's definitely a terrible thing that's been done to her. She doesn't have lots of other options.
You know, these notices, Brent, that you know that they gave her, at least I don't have the original notices immediately available, but as you pointed out, these were not meant to be used outside.
No.
As far as I know, they were, you know, concerned with maintaining an atmosphere inside the library so patrons would not be disturbed, or let's put it this way, library personnel would not be worried that patrons might be disturbed, which I think is often the case when you get these rules suddenly coming down as a sort of a control mechanism. But, of course, as you know, the whole area around the library has become a forbidden zone at night. In fact, after the library closes, even if it's not night, you now have this, you know, get out, this is closed property, as though there was some kind of threat by a person sitting by. They've removed all the benches, they've removed the greenery.
No, that's not true. The most of the benches are there. They removed two benches that were up at the top path walkway because they were deteriorating.
Well, I'm talking about the benches.
All of the other benches are still in place.
Well, no, they removed the benches from across from City Hall, for instance. There used to be benches there.
I don't think they removed any benches at City Hall either.
No.
What they did was they made placards that you're not able to sit on the rock wall anymore, right?
Well, no. I'm not saying that there weren't benches at City Hall. There were benches on the library property across from City Hall that were removed in 2014 or 2015. That's my recollection.
Okay, I see. Granted.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's become a part of the gentrification program, the homeless get out of sight in the downtown Santa Cruz area, from my perspective. But what have you seen in the last week or two that you think is worthy of comment? This is one incident you thought was sufficiently important to put up on your website.
Yeah, mainly it's because I always try to take a photograph as we do, of citations, stay away orders. This one in particular was unique. I hadn't seen it before. Every box was checked. It was a 14-day stay-away order. Had her name in it with a DTN number. I don't know what a DTN number is. I don't know what that means. Maybe that was an officer's name. But I know this person. Warming Center gives this person blankets and clothing. I see the person on a daily basis and other people who congregate with this person, and we know it's been a challenge. The person's behaviors are challenging. So I never know what to say about these things. All we can do on our side, on our humanitarian work side, which often is different than, you know, either activism or understanding the difficulty that the library has. But I really wish there were more offered a person like this. There were five or six, actually four women in that general area who sleep outside. Now, we could say, why aren't they accessing the winter shelter? Why aren't they going into treatment? Why aren't they, you know, doing this or that? I think that's, for my work, it's beside the point that they are there and they deserve dignity and clean, safe spaces to be in, or at least some amount of compassion and empathy for the circumstance that they're stuck in.
And there may be very good reasons why each of those programs either has rejected them, or they can't use those programs, or those programs are ending.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said. In terms of other news, downtown follies continue. A lot of that means there are some people who are stealing from people who sleep outside. This is a problem. I don't know who's doing this. If it's sometimes it's out of towners who are partying late at night and they come through and take things, or they're violent with people who are trying to sleep. Other times we hear that a person who is also a homeless type person is going around taking things from people. What ends up happening is people who have finally gotten a good backpack or a sleeping bag, or their entire day bag is stolen, which is a catastrophe for somebody. You know, it's their ID, their EBT card. All kinds of things are, you know, often people are being pickpocketed. That's something that's happening while somebody's sleeping. Somebody's going through their pockets. Often people are inebriated. You know, they drink alcohol and then they go to sleep, and so they're less aware. So that's been happening at a constant rate, which begs, you know, need for the storage program, because we really think that, you know, it's not going to help with the pickpocketing, but people should be able to have a safe space for backup materials, for blankets. They should be able to put their day bag in a safe space while they go off to sleep. Ideally, you know, a system like this, if it's not going to be paired with any other program, that would mean a person would be sleeping there with their sleeping bag with no other personal belongings that they have to worry about. And then they can just stow their sleeping bag in the morning and pick up their day bag.
What do you hear, Brent, about the River Street Campground, or the Boneyard Campground, as some call it, in terms of, I think I sent you the schedule that I finally got from Susie
yeah.
O'Hara.
About, thank you for,
you know, that. Where, where they, you know, where they go, they drop, they will not allow you to walk in or out, they won't allow you to have visitors, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, they do provide shuttle service and the places that they drop you off. Have you had much contact with people who've been using the program and gotten any comments, negative, positive, or otherwise?
Yeah, you know, it's cutting both ways depending on people's use. We encourage people who are accessing the camp and starting to stay there to, you know, we have lots of concern about the costs and how it's designed. But once one of our people who sleep outside is there, we encourage them to make the best use possible, because we know it has a finite amount of time that's going to be existing. Take them at their word. The city is paying a lot of money for it, and the county is supposedly there daily with services. I don't know what those services are. We don't really know what benefit is being had. We know that, of course, the Downtown Streets team is the larger population within that camp, and then a group of that population is also being hired within that camp. Again, lots to say about that, positive and negative, but if it's true that the county is putting a lot of, and I met with Ryan Coonerty's analyst, Allison, yesterday in my efforts to make a presentation to Supervisor Coonerty about some things that I would like to see the county become interested in. She was adamant that, you know, both governments, our city and county, are putting a lot of resources there, that the people who, you know, are needing these resources should really take, you know, as much benefit as possible. She agreed that the people who are outside of the camp don't get to enjoy all of the riches and opportunities that people in the camp are. But then we hear other things like, we have a friend who also, you know, has had some challenges of street life with addiction, mental health issues. Person is currently in the camp, was in a hospital for quite a while they maintained residency, and they trashed or discarded all of the personal belongings from the storage unit they have there, because they were hoping that expecting the person wasn't going to be returning to the camp, which is bizarre. The person was taken out of the camp with an ambulance because of a medical issue, and then their belongings were discarded while they were in the hospital. So that's a red flag.
Did they return to the camp?
Yes, they returned to the camp saying, you know, I'll sue you. You guys called 911 and had me, you know, taken away in an ambulance. I certainly should be able to return to the camp and was full standing. And so they, you know, under threat of being sued, I don't know if that would have really moved forward, but they were readmitted and are still in the camp, but the person has none of their previous personal belongings. And so that was a concern. But we're hearing, you know, the people who are in the camp generally are happy because it's a safe space. It's not, in my opinion, a space where somebody's going to build, self-actualize around, you know, community values, because it's kind of a nanny, a mommy space, you know, where the food is done for you once a day. You don't have to prepare or share food. There's no actual community endeavor where we're trying to keep the safe space safe together. And I again, I cite the sanctuary camp model in many other places where you do, when you don't have the protective shell of a police officer outside and the round the clock.
What about that? Let me interrupt you there, Brent. Has there been a lessening of police station across the street, surveillance, first alarm, downtown safety team inside? Have you heard?
No. The police trailer is still there. You'll see a police car parked next to it. That's an officer. Round the clock, continuing first alarm. They park in the car out front. Then you have the hired staff derived from the downtown street team who are being hired $17 an hour within. And so that entire shell of the security structure is still in place.
No change.
And the question is, to my mind, again, now we're talking about the mechanisms of the camp, good or bad.
Mm.
We already know that just 50 yards away or 100 yards away, there are people sleeping in and around Harvey West, and there are, good and bad behaviors. I don't know who's being kidded by the fact that this population in the camp requires this level of security when Harvey West is inundated with people sleeping outside, often committing crimes in the neighborhood. And some of those crimes just simply are using illegal substances, sleeping on sidewalks,
Brent, I hear you there. I noticed that as along, what is it, Limekiln or Fern, I don't know, the street that intersects with Coral Street, where there was a whole bunch of camps, during the day that were even there. They have all been, at least when I drove by, swept away about 3 or 4 days ago. Do you notice a crackdown on campers outside in the Harvey West area?
Yeah, it's kind of like the tide. It gets cracked down, it moves back, cracked down, moves back. A lot of people are being forced further into the Pogo Nip. That's all well and good during the dry season, but we keep having these rains. It's an incredible hardship for people out into those cuts on trails who have to, climb little hills and things like that and have their gear out there. I think it's idyllic for people if they can get a tent out into the woods. That's a beautiful place to be because of the aspects of nature and then other aspects of privacy that are good for people. But in terms of, I'm not getting direct reports. I'm not there every day. I will see tents removed, and then a few days later, tents returning. And you see that on Highway 1, clearing out, and then a couple, the following week, people are back. And that's kind of the way it works. It's the way it works in every city.
What do you hear about RV and car living recently, Brent?
RV and car living, because I have intimate experience with that, at least for... I'm afraid to identify areas that are better than others, but it seems the parking lot adjacent to Calvary Episcopal, that property is actually owned by Calvary Episcopal, that very large parking lot, and managed by the city. That seems to be an area where we're noticing more and more RVs, and they're not moving, so they seem to be, as long as they're paying the $5 a day, and I think that they're not being busted for that 15-minute or longer, the time that you can be in your vehicle, that seems to be a place where people are allowed to be at a longer point. When I parked my RV in a parking garage atop the parking garage on Church Street, and I happen to be in it, I will get woken up at 5:30 by a maintenance worker. And sometimes by a police officer around 3:30. We're hearing that on a routine weekly that the police department are coming through and waking people up. That's kind of new, that 3:30 a.m. call. That's normally when a dark area around schedule overlapping, right? They usually have, the night crew kind of going in by 3:00, and then the morning crew kind of emerging, around 4 or 5. So I don't know what's going on. Not that I know about schedules, but...
Have you...
A lot of the RVs are longer than 21 feet, and so a lot of the parking spaces are now... They have new signs. that you have to be under the 21-foot limit. In even areas where it's not demarcated, RVs and even the warming center shuttle from time to time is getting a ticket for being outside of the boundaries of a parking space just a little bit because it is 23 feet long. Those are expensive tickets.
Interesting. And we have the 6-foot height thing coming up too.
When is that coming up? I can't imagine that's really going to happen, but
I don't know. I mean, one can, if you were around here 15 years ago, a lot of this stuff seems, you know, unlikely, but there it is. What about what I call the parking lot panic or the parking garage paranoia citations? I saw an unusual number of those when I was looking over the February Parks and Rec ticket citation collection at the City Hall the other day. In other words, people are getting ticketed for being in a parking lot, a city parking lot, a government parking lot, where you supposedly it's there for the public. Unless you are parking or retrieving a vehicle or walking through, it's a crime, and it's a couple $100 fine, I believe. What do you hear about that? Anything?
I haven't really heard anything about that, although we know that's on the books, and it's and we know also that that is a, what do you call that?
It's an infraction.
Selective enforcement, because
yeah.
It's not for shoppers, it's not for somebody who's leaving their dear mother in the car, it's for people who are congregating or sleeping or seeking shelter. What I have noticed is during the rainstorms, the last two rain events, there would be people in the early evening congregating in a parking garage, and by 3 a.m. they're all gone, presumably driven out.
Hmm. Any indication of this so-called, maybe it's coming, big tent that will be replacing the River Street campground as a so-called emergency camp, emergency shelter, emergency structure?
The suspense is killing me. Where is it going to be? How is the city going to do this next amazing thing? Because that's the bigger thing. You know, creating this camp was a big thing for the city, admittedly. Very expensive. We haven't seen something like this done in this way ever before. And they're throwing out everything at it. You know, the entire Scott Collins salary apparently is being spent, you know, because he moved away. And that's where and they just got, Tina Schull just visited, Board of Supervisors to thank them for a $100,000 quote unquote donation, to the city specifically for the camp for 1 month operation. But where are they going to get the funding? I know that they're dealing with HAP. I actually know, that the next Homeless Action Partnership, HAP meeting is going to include an agenda item called the Coming Navigation Center. So they are doing what they think they're calling a navigation center. The first iteration is going to be what Martine Bernal calls a sprung architecture, which is a portable or a temporary warehouse type of thing, also known as a tent, you know, a mega tent. Not like a circus tent, but has a rigid steel or aluminum frame over which the, you know, usually fabric or something more, semi-permanent.
Similar to the sports arena on the other side of town, right?
Yeah, I can't imagine it's going to be that large. I'll be surprised if it's going to include more than 100 people. Again, if they're really authentically doing something like this, this is the time, the camp I had lots of concern about, because it overshot my personal work and research around the sanctuary type camp model that I'm still trying to move forward at the county and state level in some time. But this, you know, we do need emergency drop-in shelters in Santa Cruz. We do need, I want to see more options, because many of the people we know who experience homelessness don't access shelters because it's not their type of homelessness. There are many types of people, and they're afraid and resistant to being in a shelter because they're trying to not homeless themselves. That's a label. You and I likely wouldn't access that shelter either. We might try to fend for ourselves in ways. But anyway, I'm interested to see how they're going to design it. I would like to be involved. I have to stay back and just do the work that we're doing, you know, building a storage program that's still coming, doing a good job on the warming center, and encouraging city and county to design a certification. execution process that's on the that's an ordinance on the books to for a nonprofit operator of a transitional encampment.
Brent,
program design, not actually a program.
You mentioned a homeless partnership meeting coming up, which they'll be talking about this pop-up tent, maybe, if it happens. Do you know when that's happening and where?
Tony Gardner sent an email. I don't have that in front of me here. I think it's next Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Always, it's at the United Way over in Capitola. It's the, I don't know if it's monthly or quarterly, the Homeless Action Partnership. And a person has to, they prefer RSVP. And I'll send you a link to that. I'll send you a copy of that email. The members of the public are welcome to come. They just want an RSVP.
Will you be going to that meeting yourself?
It's usually earlier than my wake up, but I would like to go there and sit in. I want to go sit in there, but I don't really have a role as the director of the warming center with that topic. It would be my other roles, which are more controversial for that body. So I have to be careful how I use myself.
Mm-hmm. What's with the waiting list and the turnover in the campground? Do you have any information on that?
Fridays at, I think between 8 and 10 at the, I believe, at the library. No, I think it's 10 o'clock at the library. That's when you go and sign up. I think there's a waiting list now. There's a KION report, I just saw a news item last night that says that there are 58 people within the encamp. That's the latest number. That is a low number now, especially that we know that the camp is costing more than $100 per month. On, under 60 people. But in terms of anything around, length of stay, I did ask permission, as you maybe know, to post the schedule of the shuttle for the River Street Camp on Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz, the Facebook page. She said, yeah, it's totally public, but just make sure that everybody knows it's you can only access the encampment if you're a member, if you're signed up. You can't get on the shuttle. They don't want people to greet the shuttle. And additionally, that the only point of contact is at the library or donations on Friday between 8 and 11 at the City Hall, Department 10.
Well, what about communications with members in the campground? I'd heard that Sandy Brown at City Council, as you may remember, presented some concerns that communications were interrupted and were not allowed between members who are inside the camp and people outside wishing to communicate with them.
Yeah, I have no success. I can't approach the camp. They act like I'm raiding the wall. I can't. They don't answer any questions. You can't pass a note. They said you would be able to. You can only do that by trying to encounter the person outside of the encampment in town, which is hit or miss. So it's I find it really difficult. What I've been doing is locating an individual coincidentally and then sending messages into the camp to the people I find coincidentally, and I've been able to communicate with some of the people in the camp that way.
Do you have any phone connections with people inside the camp?
No, and I'm surprised about the very limited phone ownership and usage of the people in the camp. I don't really know, I would really like to know how, what's being done. People who have phones are having a difficult time charging them. I'm surprised they don't have a full-on charging station there. They must have a charging station, or at least outlets, and I know they do. So I don't know. I feel like I'm flying blind with this, and I'm not interacting with lots of people. I do know they don't receive clothing. You can't give them a bag of clothing and have that enter the camp as donations. They're only taking donations of sleeping bags, pads, socks. I think that's it. But they're not taking clothing, and they only have the one meal. So what's true is people are, for instance, the guy I told you about who had lost the entire contents of his storage bins while he was in the hospital has been desperately in need of clothing. So I have to try to arrange for him to meet me, and we've been meeting up coincidentally to get him some clothing. And everybody needs underwear. I keep hearing that. So that's, I'm going to try to, deliver underwear to Susie O'Hara. Maybe they can bring a bunch of underwear into the camp. Also, that one meal a day has been challenging people because you have some people trying to sneak food in, hoarding food in their tents, and some stories about food going bad and then having them be threatened with removal because they have, the bugs, gnats or whatever from the floating, from the food. I don't know. This is all I'm hearing. I don't know what's true.
What's the story, Brent, with the privacy of tents? We've heard, for example, you've talked about this several months ago when the San Lorenzo campground was still active. There was a real question as to whether rangers felt authorized to be able to actually go into a tent without permission because of some court rulings in some parts of the state or something, which I haven't got any kind of specific reference to. But you hear that privacy is being respected in the tents, it's not being respected, that it's a
mix. We always want to watch for Fourth Amendment rights to privacy, that a tent is an enclosed domicile. Doesn't matter anything, we just always stand on that. No one ever has an opportunity to look in your tent, and when they do, they're breaking a law.
Right, but what about the River Street campground?
I'm hearing that they're not. In fact, in the article that I just looked at last night, I think it's on KION, said that they're not. Mark Hemmersbach, who's a friend of mine, was reported in the article saying they're not looking in tents. So that's really good to hear. I think that they don't want rotting food in the tent. What I would like to is hear the full protocol when somebody's entering on the shuttle van and they have a backpack or a bag. Is their stuff searched? That's a big question. And then as they're entering their tent, are they able to bring whatever materials that they have on the shuttle into their tent? I think that's if you're providing dignity to the individual, people should have the ability to have that level of privacy. Of course, noting that they have other rules like no use of alcohol and drugs in the camp. But when you sign onto that sort of a rule, they shouldn't have ability to search your stuff repeatedly day in and day out. So I'm wondering if the searching is happening. And I only mention that because we talk about the true healing of the individual. People are healed by making and sharing food, sharing things that they have, helping each other, also feeling trusted, safe, and having lots of dignity so that they can begin this sort of process of, rebuilding their autonomy, rebuilding their own self-esteem. If your bag is continually checked, you're in a secure space protected by a police officer and a security guard, you never make your own food, you don't share stuff. There's almost no way to really heal at the deeper levels of personality.
Brent, I appreciate you having taken the time. I'm running out of it, so I'm going to say goodbye. Any last 30-second discussion of anything?
As always, warmingcenterprogram@gmail, warmingcenterprogram.com. There's lots of information there. The hotline is 831-234-9848. Look at the Facebook page, Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz. That's really starting to get a lot of attention. People are looking that independent of any of our activism. People who don't necessarily agree on with us are looking at that and starting to engage in dialogue. I'm really hoping that's true because
I like that site, but I got to roll. Thank you very much.
Be well. Bye, buddy.
Bye-bye. And that's it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Hopefully the delivery wasn't too bad. We had a kind of primitive system here, but maybe it will improve when I try my Sunday show, if I venture on that one. That'll be at 9:30 on April 15th. Income tax day. Let's go out on Garfunkel and Oates' song, Loser. If you want to catch the video with it, go to YouTube. If you want to catch me, give me a call, 831-423-4833, 423-HUFF.
You didn't do it, didn't reach your goal. Your heart is broken, you're an asshole. In the end, you didn't have what it takes. So here's to you and your huge mistake. You're humiliated, hollowed out, and exhausted. You were in the ring fighting the fight, and you lost it. This isn't your time, this wasn't for you. At least you did everything you could do. You're a loser but a dreamer. You're tired but you're strong. What's going on? No evidence. You don't listen to common sense. You went all in, and you were wrong. why people don't do it. Losing is hard, they can't make it through it, but not you. You are such a loser. You are such a loser. Here's to you, 'cause you deserve a cheering section too. Throw your heart at it, so what if you break it? You know now that you're strong enough to take it. Don't let it break you, don't let them break you. They can keep going till you have a breakthrough. Icarus is bullshit, that's why it's called mythology. People can't stand genius without an apology. Forget that, forget them, go get what you wanna get. Let them stay home and comment on the internet. You're a loser but a dreamer, you're tired but you're strong. You're going on no evidence, you don't listen to common sense. You went all in, and you were wrong. You're such a loser, good for you. It's something that a lot of people can't do. Trying is hard, that's why people don't do it. Losing is hard, they can't make it through it. But not you. You are such a loser. You are such a loser. Here's to you, 'cause you deserve a cheering section too. Set yourself up so high. Who really cares? But this time it didn't fly. At least you tried. At least you tried. At least you're not the guy watching from the side. Who thinks he's doing better 'cause he wasn't defeated, when he's just a non-entity who never competed. You're the one who's out there reaching for something greater. And you know it's better to be a spectator. And you are such a loser. You are such a loser. So here's to you.
Direction and purpose in the lion pride. Will you be the one? Oh, for the mountains and valleys are the city streets. Will you be the one? Oh, to keep moving forward.
Me tried, me not go swear. Mental liberation, now you're relaying. I said we got to stand up, my people. Shift gear and forward like vehicle. I guess we got to stand up.